from LPM.
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson. Welcome to Race Unwrapped, a podcast unwrapping all the ways race affects our world, whether we're thinking about it or not. My guest this episode is Curtis Tate. Curtis grew up in Kentucky and is the son and grandson of immigrants. He's also a reporter with West Virginia Public Radio covering energy and the environment. In this episode, we discuss how anti-Asian rhetoric can encourage violence against Asian Americans. This is Race Unwrapped. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, and my guest this episode is Curtis Tate. He's a biracial Vietnamese-American journalist who was raised in Somerset, Kentucky, and in this episode, we're going to talk about the influence of language on anti-Asian violence.
I'm Curtis Tate. I write about and produce radio segments on energy and the environment. My mom is Vietnamese, and my father is white, and I grew up in a place where I kind of stuck out. Okay. It's a very majority white place, as is much of the region it's in. And so that was a different kind of experience for me and for my sister as well.
Do you feel as if, I mean, of course you stood out because if you live in a very white environment and you're anything but white, that makes you stand out. Were there any experiences that you had as a biracial Vietnamese man that or a biracial Vietnamese boy that stood out to you?
Well, the kids did do the slanted eye thing, even though I'm not, I look pretty ambiguous, mm-hmm. I think. Believe me, I've been mistaken for every kind of Asian but the one I actually am. Yeah. But they still picked up on that. They knew I was different. They knew that my hair looked different and my skin tone was a little different, and you know, maybe my eyes and nose look a little different too, but they definitely knew that my mom didn't look like their moms. And so, you know, I don't think most of what I encountered was what I would call mean-spirited. You know, there's that slanty eye thing that the kids did, and they would try to make up a language that they thought sounded Chinese or Asian, you know, the ching-chong kind of thing.
Lord, that does not change from generation to generation. Every friend I've had who's Asian, regardless of age, has that story.
Here was the moment I remember especially. I was in elementary school, and one day I thought, well, why not bring a box of noodles to school and some chopsticks? And I swear, I might as well have been on display at a zoo or, you know, enclosed in a glass case the way that they were staring and pointing at me that day. I never did it again.
Oh, man. Yeah, but those are the little things that do make a difference, though, right? Like, when you can probably still remember that moment when you were stared at for something as innocent as bringing food from home.
Right.
And people don't realize that those things can impact you just as much as more outrageous to your face sort of things, you know, and which takes me to the language of race. So, you know, there's been a rise and an increase of Asian hate. Now, do you think there's a rise in it, or do you think that people are just more aware of it?
I think that people are more aware of it, but it's hard not to notice that this heightened awareness comes on the tail of hearing some very problematic statements from, you know, certain political figures, and also this connection between, you know, first it was the Chinese virus, and now it seems like because the coronavirus is, you know, is really surging in India, I've been hearing that a lot of Indian Americans are facing increased harassment. Or that more of it's being reported.
You already hit upon the thing I was going to ask about. Former President Donald J. Trump was very fond, and, you know, he may still be fond of it. We just don't hear him as much anymore. Of saying Asian flu. I mean, at one point, I think he even made some joke and called it the Kung Fu, or maybe somebody else did that. But it's a lot of really racist characterization of the coronavirus. Do you think that has an impact on people, just, you know, Asian Americans just walking around?
I think it does. And I was thinking about this earlier. You know, there's that whole notion about the model minority. You know, we come here, we work hard, we pay our taxes. We make sure our children get the best educational opportunities they can and work so that they can succeed. And people who maybe have this mindset don't necessarily think, oh, well, this country, some people in this country are going to, you know, all of a sudden turn out to be very racist toward Asian Americans. It is a little bit jarring, but it maybe isn't surprising given the history that we have going back to the Chinese Exclusion Act and so many other things.
Absolutely. The Chinese Exclusion Act, the Japanese internment camps are something that I just think that people, one of the many things we don't study enough in our American history classes, and especially because I'm a context person. I mean, we're not talking this happened 500 years ago. I mean, this country isn't that old for that to be part of its heritage. And I just wonder if this more recent increase in violence against Asian Americans, how much of that has been triggered by people being very, I don't know, free and easy with the racial commentary and the racial slurs.
Right. And also the anti-immigration sentiment, mostly toward people who are crossing the southern border. But I don't know. Sometimes I hear people like Tucker Carlson question the 1965 Immigration Act, which basically is the reason why my mom and my grandparents became U.S. citizens. Mm. It lifted a lot of restrictions that were in place before that would have precluded that. And so now, I mean, for years and years and years, it seemed like both Democrats and Republicans could agree that the 1965 Act was a good thing and that immigrants were desirable and hardworking and patriotic. Ronald Reagan even thought so. But anymore, you hear a lot of voices, especially on the right, calling all of that into question. Mm-hmm. And you even had people who were working for President Trump, Stephen Miller, for example, who were actively trying to dismantle what happened in 1965.
It gets back to, you know, my whole point about language, right? Because language creates impressions in people's minds, and people act on what impressions they have. Like, one of the words that I think is crazy that it's become a triggering word is immigration.
Yes.
Don't you think? What do you think about that?
The things that have emerged in these past 5 to 10 years, especially after President Obama was elected, but then also continuing even more so under President Trump, a lot more anti-immigration and anti-immigrant sentiment, the likes of which I had not heard before.
Yeah. Do you mind my asking, how old are you?
42.
So, and I'm, you know, I'm in my 50s, and I've noticed that too. I mean, I'm old enough to have seen how there's just been a different way that people use immigration. You're right. I feel like immigration was synonymous with model minority as long as we weren't talking about people from Mexico or Haiti or any dark. Basically, if you were an immigrant and you were dark skinned of any kind, it almost was like the word immigration wasn't used or immigrant wasn't used. A phrase that grates on my ears, I don't care how many times I hear it, is illegals. when I hear people refer to by the word illegals. It just is like chalk, fingernails on a chalkboard, you know?
How can a person be illegal?
Right. Right. And I had somebody try to explain to me, well, you know, it's not really as offensive as it sounds. It's just a description of their legal status. I'm like, it's not just merely an expression of their status when you refer to human beings as illegals. You know, it'd be even different if they said illegal immigrants. Okay. But shorthanding it to illegals. Wow. So let me ask you this, as a professional, Asian American man, do you find still that people are surprised when you show up on the scene as somebody who's not just a white dude? No disrespect to white dudes.
I did sort of feel that way. And I don't know if this is going to surprise you or not, but when I covered Congress, the Capitol Hill press corps is overwhelmingly white.
Mm-hmm.
And I stood out there too.
Mm-hmm.
And there are times that I felt like maybe I was treated a little bit differently by security and some of the other staff, not in a menacing sort of way, but just like, you know, being asked to show my ID a little bit more clearly, whereas some of my white colleagues could just breeze on through without anyone batting an eye.
And do you think that in part comes because you look Asian American, but you've got the name Curtis Tate?
Right. An Asian person with a non-Asian sounding name.
Right.
That's my southern side, the Mississippi and Alabama. I don't know. It's hard to know exactly what people expect sometimes. You know, I have received that sort of faux compliment about how good my English is.
Oh, no.
It's kind of like, well, it's kind of like, I'm conversational.
I mean, it's just, it's nuts. I've a frequent question that I've heard friends and people who are Asian American say is people saying to them, so where are you from? Sacramento.
Oh, that's a classic.
Oh man, do you still get that?
Where are you from?
I'm from Somerset, Kentucky. Okay, yeah, but where are you really from?
Well, you know, my sister used to have a good answer. You know, where were you born? She said the hospital.
but again, where do you? What conversational pieces do you think people are having that they feel as if that is a question that makes sense to them?
I don't think that people mean anything. I don't think they mean any harm by it in most cases. But it's a clumsy sort of way of asking a question that they don't really quite know how to ask. They could say, you know, well, you know, what's your cultural background? You know, I don't know. There are other ways to say it, hopefully imply that you're interested in finding out a little bit more about the person you're talking to rather than just kind of othering the other person.
And so that was exactly what I was going to say. That gets back to the language, right? Because the language of asking, oh, man, what's your cultural heritage? You know, which is, I think, you might hear in this sort of open, curious way versus, so where are you from? No, where are you from? Where are you from really? That othering.
I wouldn't mind if somebody asked me, which Asian are you?
Right. Okay. That's legitimate, right? So because why do people mush everything into you must be Chinese?
Better to cast a wide net than make that mistake. Oh, how's your Japanese? Non-existent.
Right. I'm sure the temptation would be, I mean, look, I'm kind of a smartass. So if you and I were having lunch at a sushi restaurant and somebody asked you about your Japanese, I probably would step in and say something stupid like, look, you know, if you want him to say unagi instead of eel, just say that. But, you know, don't try to other him and make him a race that he is not. So circling back to kind of where we are right now with Asian Americans and names, you know, we had the recent issue with Asian Americans being killed, right?
Yes.
And that was really just one of those things that when you hear about it, you just, ugh. How much of that do you think comes from a culture of people feeling like it's just okay to marginalize people to the point of death?
You know, it's hard for me to imagine that any of the people I grew up with would have felt that way. They accepted me as an individual, even if their politics around immigration and cultural identity may have been in some other place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really kind of hard to answer that.
Right.
I obviously there are some people who think that it's okay to mark somebody who looks or sounds foreign for harm or for death. But I would hope that that's not the vast majority of people.
Sure. Do you feel as if, because sometimes I find that the negative can be eye-opening for the people who mean well but take things for granted. So do you think that because of recent events combined with even before Trump saying Asian flu, which had to have made folks who didn't think about anti-Asian sentiment before go, what? No, he did not say that. And then he said it again and again and again.
He kept saying it.
How many other people who might not have had such a blatant sense of anti-Asian sentiment now go, well, the president repeats it. What's the big deal if I do?
Well, I think it may have empowered people who, for whatever reason, think that they have an entitlement to use whatever kind of slurs they want towards whomever, but they mean no harm somehow.
Right.
They're trying to push back against wokeness and political correctness, and this is kind of their way of acting out.
Right. It's very easy for language to be part of the conversation about race in ways that are very dismissive. Like when people sneer as they say the word woke, or they've elevated cancel culture to this some sort of a thing of eliminating whiteness. And it's like, no, it's not really cancel culture. It's consequence culture. I mean, we've always been offended by certain things. We just didn't have the collective power or the avenues of social media to protest against it.
Well, I don't know about you, but I'm still not sure how Dr. Seuss got canceled.
Right. And he didn't get canceled. That's the thing. It's like nobody canceled Dr. Seuss. In fact, his own people, his estate holders just said, you know, Dr. Brotherman had a few questionable books out here. I think we need to retire those. But the cat still got the hat. We can still enjoy the green eggs and ham.
I mean, is Disney canceled just because they won't stream Song of the South?
Right, exactly. I mean, hello, consequences. And let's not, my fellow Kentuckian, let's not even talk about my old Kentucky home and the people who are outraged that people are offended. And that's, again, back to words, back to absolute words. Like, I remember with my boyfriend at the time going to see 30 years ago, back when I lived in Kentucky 30 years ago, something in Bardstown where they sang My Old Kentucky Home, including the verse where the darkies are gay. And they had people, and they had people down there playing slaves. And we didn't even say a word. We just looked at each other and got up and left. It was an outdoor. And again, words, right? Like, theoretically, what's the big deal about a word until it's a word against you? So one thing I'm clear on is that people would be better off just gently inquiring about what your Asian background is, or I'm going to call it your Asian pedigree. What is your Asian pedigree? And is there another word thing involved with being an Asian American that either grates on you or that you wish people would be more sensitive about? Or
I don't know if there's a particular word that comes up, but you know, going back to that example about what I experienced in the cafeteria in grade school, this idea that we're perpetually foreigners, that idea is something that really kind of, you know, gets under my skin, because my mom and my grandparents came to this country and they became citizens. Why do some people think they're less American than they are?
Yeah, that phrase is so true, perpetual foreigners.
As opposed to real Americans. Well, what do you mean?
That was Curtis Tate, a journalist with West Virginia Public Radio. In our next episode, I'll talk to Dr. Kendra Calhoun about how the pejorative use of the word Karen has become a five-letter shorthand for entitlement. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson. Thank you for listening to Race Unwrapped.
Race Unwrapped is produced by Michelle Tyrene Johnson. Our executive producer is Laura Ellis. Audio assistance from Eric Matthews. And music by Allison Cross. From LPM, Louisville Public Media.